Could I just ask Terry if he'd mind just commenting for a minute in the bureaucratic and wider view of St Kevin, where the unions might fit in this process?
Good question, Ian. I think nobody really knows the answer to that, and certainly the unions don't know the answer to that. They think, I mean, the clear impression on the night of the election was they thought that they'd won Tats Lotto with the change of government and the commitment to abolishing work choices, which was delivered on. But since then, it's clear that both in the macroeconomic sense, that this government is prepared to both accept, because the Reserve Bank is independent, what Chris was talking about, the clear intention of the Reserve Bank to slow economic activity, which has two impacts, obviously, in this context of the question, that it will cause unemployment to rise and it will make it difficult to aggressively articulate the union campaign in the broader industrial relations context. And secondly, as indicated, they are going to be taking tough decisions in the budget. So the combination is not one that's conducive to increasing union power in the real world. And there's no indication that even St. Julia, which would be the great white hope, so to speak, of the union movement, of the top four in the government, is going to be pushing an aggressive pro-union line. She's driven by the same realism of the government, which is one that is, despite the clear indication that they would have very little opposition at the next election, that they want to make sure that they don't repeat the great iconic mistakes of the Whitlam period or, more narrowly, the latter period of the Keating government. So this government is very focused on those sorts of outcomes and is not going to accommodate either the generalised reawakening of union power or any form of structured accord.
Thanks, Terry.
Ian, if I might. Trevor Lloyd from
Thanks,
Chris
Trevor.
Cox. We know each other reasonably well. I know nothing about economics. I'm a lawyer. But there is something I noticed, Chris, in your slides, and it's most noticeable. It shows in quite a few slides, but it's most noticeable in the detail of your slides of the real metal prices and of the non-farm employment in the US. And it's to do with the entry shape of the graph as you're heading into recession. And this one looks a much more tentative entry to recession than any other we've previously seen. And I just wondered if I could take you down into the detail and ask whether you've yet had an opportunity not to prematurely extrapolate, but to think about why that might be.
I haven't had an opportunity for quite some time. I think that's a natural conclusion to draw when you look at that chart. That employment is slowing and it will go negative, but it doesn't seem to be slowing as rapidly as in the earlier recessions, and so that could give you some grounds for thinking, well, this recession could turn out to be mild. There is one caveat to that, and that is that it's a little difficult to explain, but a lot of the employment growth, of course, in the US and in any other economy comes from new businesses who aren't in the sample. And in order to correctly measure employment growth, it's necessary basically to make an estimate of how much employment change is coming from new businesses outside the sample, and it is an estimate. And when growth in employment tends to slow, there's a suspicion that estimate, that it takes a while for that estimate to catch up with what's going on in the rest of the economy. And so I think your depiction of the current state of the chart is absolutely accurate. It does look like the descent isn't as steep, and so the recession may be milder, but beware of revisions. A year from now, we may go back to that chart and it may look just as steep. That would be my concern.
Thanks. Rod McDonald, City of Greater Geelong. I've got a question for Professor Pinkus. Jonathan, you spoke about the overlap and duplication having costs, but then you also said that if it was worth it if the competition improved the process of government. I guess that leads to the $64 million question. How do you measure it?
Well, we'll find out, because the Rudd government is going to measure everything for us. everything of importance will be determined in advance, and measures will come out. That's my flippant answer. My other answer is competition, unfortunately, doesn't allow you to come up in advance with good measures. The process of competition gives you outcomes that you couldn't have predicted if you'd sat down and thought, exactly what outcome do I want? Let me write it all down. So my second answer is even worse than premature. What was it again? Belated withdrawal. That your question implies the answer to the question. Namely, we know in advance what it is that competition is going to provide and exactly how it's going to do a very good job. At the Productivity Commission, any time the Commission has been advocating increased competition, it makes no attempt to predict exactly what that competition is going to produce. It makes an argument that competition is going to do a good job, and that's my argument.
So can I just on that, how do we know then that it has been achieved? That's what you might know at the beginning, but at the end, how do you go about deciding that?
Retrospectively, people can look and say, all of these things looked reasonably okay, and all of these things looked pretty crook. Once again, the Productivity Commission has done quite a lot of that, looking back on national competition policy, what things seemed to work and what things didn't seem to work. But in advance, when the Commission was advocating it, it had no idea what was going to look good or bad. So looking backwards, you have your criteria and you apply them and you see how good it looks. But that doesn't get to your question. Your question is, can we guarantee in advance that we'll get good outcomes? And the answer is no.
Adrian Clowden, Chairman of Serco and Director of CEDRA, and pleased to be so. My question relates, many of us in the business community relate to government for one reason or another, and my question relates to the role and position of officials, of bureaucrats, in the new regime. We've seen the Prime Minister take to himself quite a lot of authority and power that ministers would otherwise have. I understand ministers now have KPIs for outcomes, and previously they would have been policymakers rather than deliverers, so that seems to me to push them down into the role that officials would have, and I understand at COAG ministers will chair some of the subcommittees that officials previously chaired. So my question and a related question is, what is the role of officials in the new regime? Has that been resolved? Do they understand it? And how should the business community relate to them? And the second part of the question relating to officials is, the Prime Minister has explained that if the states don't deliver on services, he will help them deliver on services. Federal government has no expertise in the delivery of services. Where will the officials and bureaucrats come from in the federal system to deliver, if required, to help the states perform?
One aspect to the seamlessness of the transition is the almost unprecedented situation that none of the heads of departments have been replaced, so that there have been some retirements, but no one's actually been shifted in the way that we saw both in 96 or progressively after 96. And there's no suggestion that it's just been delayed for a few months. I think this is an evolving process on two levels, specifically in relation to your question, in terms of how... I mean, Kevin is very controlling in terms of this whole process of forcing the ministers into perform in a certain way. You talk about KPIs. The other aspect of this is this enforced kitchen cabinet, community cabinets, and they all had to go out and visit two community centres or whatever it was. I can't remember the specific detail. So there's that very controlling dynamic. But the reality is that government will out as this process continues, and ministers can't take the roles of departmental heads or indeed departments in a wider sense. And I think as this process evolves, you will see a return or a continuation rather than a return to more normal processes of the relationships between ministers and their departments and the whole cabinet process. So the way that business will relate to government in the broad will be the same as essentially as it's related to government in the previous administration and indeed in the Keating period.
I spent a large amount of my life working in universities. The Commonwealth funds them, has no idea how to run them.
but it has a very good idea of how they should be run. That is, it specifies this year exactly what the universities have to do, and they try to do it, and then that turns out to have very, very bad effects, so it specifies next year a completely different set, all with their multiple and accumulative reporting mechanisms. So in answer to the question of how the Commonwealth will set the criteria, I think we've seen them. They're the ones which will get on the front page of the major newspapers. And most organisations have multiple objectives. Some of those objectives were picked out as politically salient and relevant, and they're the ones which will be aimed at. The consequences of them will be other important things will get put set to one side and won't be performed up to standard, and so we'll have an ongoing process of revising the goals in order to take account of the response of the state service agencies to how are we going to meet this one. Well, we just modify what we do, since no longer this other thing that we thought was terribly important gets money.
I guess I can add to that, as a having spent 15 years in the state health system at a board level, in an era when we sent copious reports to the regional office, to the state head office, and to the Canberra office of the Federal Department of Health, and I often wondered what they did beyond take up more filing cabinets every year in terms of the usefulness of all of that information.
Okay, I think on the left-hand side. Michael
Schneider from VNOVA Asset Management. Question probably more so for Chris, but Terry might have his own views on this as well. And there was one potential asymmetry you commented on, Chris, earlier, where the ability of Western governments and central banks to influence commodity prices is probably the lowest it's been since the Industrial Revolution, when you talked about China and India and particularly the Eastern Hemisphere. I just wondered whether you had a view on another potential asymmetry where, at least in the US, the risk that America's political and economic interests are diverging. And what I mean by that is determining what assets are for sale, what assets aren't for sale, running budget deficits in prosperous economic times, and determining who fails and who doesn't fail, e.g. bear stearns. So in other words, if there's a divergence, protectionism, I guess, is another risk. If there's a divergence between economic and political risks, in the same way there's a potential divergence in the ability of banks to influence commodity prices, what implications you might see or what risks you might see of that going forward?
I think I don't fully understand either the question or the analogy, but I'll have a crack. Yes, I suppose that the interplay, if you like, between the economic cycle and the political cycle there are some risks involved there. The current president in the US, of course, pretty much assured that they would be dealing with a fairly large deficit for some time there. It was, of course, the US federal deficit was too big given the state of the economy. It was at least coming down, and it's about to blow out again. I guess you could look at the blowout where the deficit will double from, let's say, around 150 to more than $300 billion in the next year. I guess you could look at that as probably the correct response, given the current weakness of the US economy. I suspect there's also a dimension of your question that relates to the degree of regulation, if you like, as a result of what's going on there now, and as a result, for example, of the Federal Reserve basically stepping in the Bear Stearns matter, we may finish up with a trifle. Well, essentially, because it's been, you know, it's been interpreted as a crisis and things have been done in the crisis, and perhaps it is believed that there wasn't enough regulation beforehand, we may finish up with some unwise policy and down the track. And I guess the same thing is a possible outcome of the of attempts to help given to home buyers. We may finish up alleviating the current crisis, but putting in place a series of mechanisms that are not useful in the long term. But I guess my feeling right now, is that you basically, when the boat's sinking, you bail and you worry about The consequences of that later. Now, that may not have fully answered your question, Terry, but I'll let you have a go.
Sorry, it actually did. My question was a little bit ambiguous, was around what possible implications on global growth that might have going forward. So you got to the heart of the question anyway.
Thank you. Just add a couple of points. I don't know that I can quite address your question either, but talking to Tom Albanese, the head of Rio Tinto, the day before yesterday, or it might have been yesterday, I can't remember, I move so quickly. He made the interesting point, very minor point, that Rio and all the mining industry is still having difficulty getting tyres. They first raised this issue 4 or 5 years ago, and you'd think something as simple as tyres, surely the production process could be geared up. But it was demonstrative of two things: the difficulty, the strength, the real strength of this global demand that's been raging in the last 5 years. That even when something as simple as that can't really catch up. And that momentum, I think, is still there to some extent, which is underlying the cyclical shift that Chris was talking about and the policy responses, I guess, and add on the financial reversals that have taken place. I don't see anybody around the world setting out to specifically bring down commodity prices per se. And that's clearly not the case when you look at the policy momentum in virtually every other country apart from Australia, which is cutting interest rates, hardly a process which is going to address commodity prices. And our central bank is obviously not setting out to reduce commodity prices per se, but there's a combination, I think, of the cyclical dynamic which Chris was in large part talking about, and the reality that the realities always come out, the dynamics which caused the world economy to slow, or is in the process of causing the world economy, something that happens all the time. You can't deny it. Overlaid that is the secular change, which is a consequence of Chinese demand, which is unprecedented in terms of any previous period, including Japan. So there's all those are sort of in the pot over the next year, the next 2 years, and it's going to be a very mixed dynamic.
John Dalton from the Victorian Department of Innovation, Industry and Regional Development. Just wanted to raise a question to do with the political outlook and another to do with the economic outlook to the panel generally. No one's commented on the unusual, unique political situation we find ourselves in our history, where we have one party in power across the entire nation, across all jurisdictions. And in terms of, I guess, the political electoral cycle, a comment on what implications you think that might have for the states. Particularly, if I recall the timetable correctly, New South Wales. The other economic issue to raise, no one's explicitly really mentioned potential impacts of an emissions trading scheme in Australia, and I just wonder whether there's a thought as to whether any significant structural adjustment that might need to be made, particularly in Victoria, particularly in Gippsland, whether that might impact on some of the macroeconomic forecasting for Australia or Victoria. In other words, might we see a more uneven growth across Australia in the next few years if we have to cope with the shock of an emissions trading scheme?
Let me just quickly respond to the political question. I did say that the opposition federally was irrelevant. If I'd gone on to discuss the oppositions in the states, I would have had to try and find a word which is something less than irrelevant. You look at the outcome both in the Victorian state election, but even more so in the New South Wales state election 3 years ago. John Howard had a 5.4% swing against him, and you have to objectively ask the question why, in terms of bad government or purportedly bad government. You look at New South Wales, where the government was immeasurably, by any objective assessment, worse and with real impacts on people in New South Wales, and the swing was 2.5%, and essentially the Liberal Party is ceasing to exist. Having said that, the more important question is, what is the practical reality of having nine Labor governments across Australia? Not what one might have thought 10 years ago, and certainly not what one might have thought 20 years ago, and Jonathan might want to pick up on this, that they're not going to all get in a room together and reshape Australia in the sense that we might have thought about 20 years ago, whether it's extreme socialism or some other more moderate form. The reality is that governments have to behave like governments with their own narrow self-interests. And you saw that most clearly in the case of Victoria holding out in relation to water. The Victorian government didn't sign up to the water package yesterday because you've got a state, a federal Labor government. They signed up because Rudd put an extra $1 billion on the table. So that practical reality is going to determine that. You don't have a construct which is going to have nine Labor governments completely shaping and changing Australia in a closed room.
No, I agree with what Terry said. The other one was the health agreement. The fact that the states achieve something like another $1 billion there on the argument that the Commonwealth had reduced its percentage share of the costs, but that's just for slightly complicated reasons, really a silly argument. I don't think that the chances of deep structural improvements in the Australian economy, the kind of reforms that occurred under the national competition policy, I don't think the chances of that are enhanced by having all Labor governments or worsened. I don't think it matters. It will matter a tremendous amount. The national competition policy was a mixture, which was run by a mixture of governments. It was run by, driven out of the state substantially, including a New South Wales government, which wasn't Labor, despite the fact that the Commonwealth was Labor. So I think that I agree with Terry. It's not a defining factor.
Chris, would you like to comment on the emissions trading?
Yeah, I thought I'd get left with that one. First of all, let me say that I have no expertise whatsoever in the regional or sub-regional considerations. I can't answer that part of the question at all. Other than that, I guess emissions. I think of emissions trading schemes and anything basically to. I mean, I look at this from the macroeconomic point of view. Emission trading schemes or anything that has anything to do with climate change automatically cut growth and raise inflation. There's no, this gets back to Jonathan's story about how we're actually trying to change behaviour, and so I think that, I mean, that's a given. I think the big question is just how much, and I don't think anybody knows the answer to that. And of course, the question is it's a trade-off. It's current growth down, future growth presumably higher. I just make the point that if it's going to raise inflation and raise inflation significantly, then there's an interesting interplay, if you like, between that and the Reserve Bank's inflation target. And we're going to ignore that part of inflation that comes from this desirable policy change or not. And my suspicion is that we won't, because you can't really change your target for it's not going to be 2 to 3 anymore, it's going to be 2.3 to 3.3 or whatever. But there is going to be some interesting interplay there when we do start deliberately making large policy changes that impact inflation. But beyond that, as I said, I can't get to the regional implications at all.
Ivan Deverson, 40 years in the car industry, I've put up with the denigration of the character of used car salesmen. But I can't help but feel that in recent times, questions of integrity in the financial sector beg a question of more regulation. We're looking at Northern Rock, at Bear Stearns, at subprime lending, and the list goes on and on and on. Obviously, some of it is impacting us here in Australia, where, as you said, Chris, we've got a strong economy, and yet the ASX is going down to the basement. What, if any, regulatory reform would you like to see that's come out of recent events in the financial sector?
My honest answer to that is I don't know. I mean, my suspicion is you're right, that this is something that does have to be looked at, and maybe there are grounds for more regulation. My concern about this, as I mentioned earlier, I've got my own bike, and the way I think about this is the drug use in the Tour de France. Every year they tighten up, and it depends really who's got the better chemists or the less ethical chemists. And my suspicion is the financial engineers, no matter what you do, right, the financial engineers will always find a way to step outside the current bounds of regulation and potentially do some more damage that way. But I think after this is all settled down, yes, we do need to take a look at what can be done. But regulation to me always comes with a cost. For example, obviously there have been some issues relating to short selling and targeted short selling. But what do you do? Short selling is an efficiency in markets. If you ban it, then your markets will be far, far less efficient than they are now. So what do you do? I'm glad it's somebody else's problem and not mine.
Ivan, I'm always concerned about regulation on the basis that, to build on what Chris was saying, that it strikes me as a roadmap for people who want to avoid it rather than a process for actually solving solutions, delivering solutions. And I think Sarbanes-Oxley, which was the great reform dynamic that came out of the dot-com era, imposed this huge burden on business without any real practical effect, beneficial effect. So I'd be very concerned about embracing regulation for regulation's sake and trying to nail down specific issues, whether it's short-selling or some other or inappropriate behaviour in financial institutions.
John Allen, independent consultant. Terry, this time last year, one of your fellow panellists, Sam Lipsky, proffered the view that the 2007 federal election would be the "it's time" election of the modern vernacular. You countered, "Governments don't change in good economic times." How would you change this rule of thumb?
How would I now change the rule of thumb? I don't know that I could easily substitute a new one, John, other than, as I indicated, that at the end of the day, they wanted the electorate, using that term loosely, wanted to keep John Howard the policy, but they wanted to change John Howard the person. It was a very unusual election in any context in the last 50 years of electoral history in this country. So I don't have an easy... it's probably a good idea that I don't try and formulate one.
Could I just perhaps throw the last question? Happy for any in the panel to comment, and it's really a mixture of political and economics in Australia. It's in regard to what I see as a bit of the conflicts that the new government's got in terms of the short term, where we've got the Reserve Bank looking for slower growth, and we've got the issue of dealing with the huge budget surpluses, which, as Chris mentioned, are growing rather than declining, as against the long-term needs of skills and infrastructure that everybody's talking about, and education. And when we look out to the next election, say in 2 years, 9 months, it'll be very hard to prove the long-term things have actually moved at all. And where will that leave the government and the population? Perhaps, I don't know if Terry, you'd like to lead off? Perhaps.
Well, I'll throw it over to the rest of the panel because I've talked enough about politics. Just make one point. Elections in the narrow tend to get decided not by the big picture and assessments on whether they've delivered on these grandiose promises, but by very simple things like interest rates, like Chris's reference to the rise in the election campaign, I think was probably the final nail in the coffin. The coffin was probably already nailed down before then. Petrol prices, there's a big... obviously a huge issue politically, if not in terms of the economy, with this conflict between the government's promise to reduce petrol prices and yet it wants to increase the price of carbon. How that's going to play out in an economic sense is one thing. How it's going to play out in a political sense is even more unpredictable, if you like, at this stage. But certainly those sorts of dynamics are going to be at work over the next 2 years.
Chris, would you like to add to that?
I don't know that I have much to add to that. I think Terry's absolutely right that elections are determined by short-term considerations and not by long-term considerations. We should still do the long-term stuff, of course, so that 15 or 20 years from now this is a better place to live, but you don't do it in order to win the next election because it's not going to be irrelevant from that point of view.
Jonathan?
I pass.
Thank you.